And now, Tucson's Hispanic Voices. The back-to-school debate is intensifying as parents are being forced to weigh the risks versus the benefits of sending children to school during the coronavirus pandemic. Under Governor Ducey's orders, schools in Arizona are expected to reopen on August 17th or face the possibility of budget cuts. The teachers' union wants remote learning to be delayed until October. Right now, Arizona continues to deal with high coronavirus cases and deaths, although the daily numbers are steadily dropping along with hospitalizations. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released guidelines emphasizing that students get back to the classroom for the sake of their own emotional well-being. But not every parent or teacher is comfortable with that. We asked one teacher, who is also a parent, if she'll send her own child back to school.
Not until it is determined that it is the safest thing to do based on the CDC guidelines and suggestions.
While politics is driving Governor Ducey to reopen schools, he's forced some businesses, including bars and gyms, to stay closed. But are all schools ready and able to implement safety guidelines in time for school to start? Will schools require face masks, temperature checks, socially distanced desks, and plexiglass dividers? Let's get answers from the superintendent of Sunnyside Unified School District. Welcome to Tucson's Hispanic Voices. I'm Steve Nunez. Governor Ducey has ordered the Arizona Department of Health Services to set health data metrics for reopening schools, but Ducey has yet to craft a statewide plan for reopening schools. Instead, as he's done all along with handling the coronavirus pandemic, he's passing the buck down to individual districts to implement safety measures, including redesigning classrooms to maintain social distancing. And in essence, the governor is also putting the burden on how to send children to school in the hands of parents. My guest today is Steve Holmes, Sunnyside Unified School District Superintendent. Steve, welcome to Tucson's Hispanic Voices.
Thank you, Steve. It's always great to hear from you. We go back a long ways, and I love what you're doing with your show, so I'm actually super glad to be on it.
I should mention, you are my fraternity brother. We attended the University of Arizona together and were members of the first Hispanic-founded fraternity at the U of A, Omega Delta Phi. Steve, likewise, I'm proud of you, your accomplishments, the great work you are doing to educate our kids in the positive direction you are taking the Sunnyside Unified School District in. Congratulations,
man. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate you.
All right, so school started for 16,000 students attending 21 schools within the district on Wednesday, August 5th. I know you've been
correct.
Working closely with local health officials on reopening schools. What are the guidelines to keep students, teachers, and staff safe? Are face masks being required? Are temperatures being taken? Are there socially distanced desks or plexiglass dividers? Take us into the classroom so that we can get a clearer picture of the safety measures that will be used to help protect children from contracting or spreading the coronavirus.
So this is what we've been working on since we pretty much closed down our campuses in March. There's been guidance that's been provided by local health officials, but also at the federal level with the Center for Disease Control. And we've been using that really to really put in place things that we believe are essential to keeping students and teachers safe. Right now, just so everyone's aware, that we are starting online only. And that was guidance that was provided by not only our state of Arizona governor's order, but specifically from our Pima County Health Department, who has said the spread is too wide for us to begin school in person. And so as we're providing online learning, we continue to iterate our mitigation efforts in the classroom. So what that would look like, absolutely students and staff are going to be required to wear face masks. Desks are going to have to be 6 feet apart. Part of our challenge is some of our classrooms are small, and to try to fit everyone with 6 feet apart is going to be more than difficult unless we have parents who choose to stay online for the whole year. In other words, whenever it's safe to start, we will begin, but we're going to give all parents and students the option to remain online if they choose to do so. That may mean that we will have enough students who are staying online to provide the spacing necessary in the classroom to put those mitigation efforts in place. So let's say 40% of our students stay online. I can accommodate 60% of the students in a safe way with 6 feet of social distancing, wearing masks. We are checking temperatures in the entrance. We also are asking parents, though, as part of our mitigation efforts, that they make sure that they're not sending their students with any kind of temperature or they're feeling ill. There's a checklist that we provided for parents to not send students there. If students actually are running temperatures. We have a room by the nurse's office that we're isolating students to be picked up so that they're not in classrooms all day. And then equally important, in areas where there's high traffic, or where the office areas where people are coming up to desks, even though parents cannot come in all the way through the building, when they're interacting with anyone that's more of a face-to-face, we have plexiglass that has been set up in the common areas, specifically in the office areas where much of the interaction takes place, notwithstanding what's happening in the classroom. I can go on and on, but we also have purchased a chemical that allows us to actually clean the desks routinely as students are shifting. However, our goal is to try to keep the cohort of students together as much as possible, just in case there is some type of student that tests positive that we can contact trace a little bit better and make better notification. As you can tell just by the quick ways in which I'm just peppering you with all these things that we're doing, it's a very complex process that we've given a lot of thought to. However, we're still going to have to work through. It's going to be iterative as we get through this. There may be some things that we haven't considered that we'll need to change on the fly as we actually bring students in whenever that time is.
And what's the threshold in the data that determines when kids will be allowed back into the classroom?
So we're still waiting for that guidance. I know the state is about to release that. I know that our Pima County Health Department has set up a red, green, yellow set of metrics that they use to open our county for business. And as of now, that seems to be the metrics that are going to be driving our opening. Right now, the majority of those are in red. However, as the state guidance gets overlaid with the county guidance, I'm sure we're going to get more of a number. But that number has not been provided for us at this point. Many other states and local jurisdictions are using this 5% spread rate as a number. I'm not sure we're going to land on that or not as a metric that actually is going to drive our decision making. But that seems to be the logic that I've seen across the nation around a spread rate.
When that day comes when kids are allowed to go back into the classroom, will there be a one-size-fits-all blueprint, or will some schools take like a hybrid approach, making all online or all in person, or a combination of both based on the data and some of the zip codes that we see that have higher infection rates? So those schools in those areas will kind of remain online, or what's the plan there?
So right now there is some unique context to each district, right? Each of us, although we collaborate as superintendents, each one has a different community that we have to work with. The guidance right now from the state is somewhat one size fits all. In other words, you either are all in or you're all online. I still feel that over time, when that time comes, there is some logic to this hybrid approach. And when I think of hybrid, I just want to make sure I'm being clear. Hybrid is not that some kids are online and some are in person, just as simple as that. There's almost three models going on simultaneously as we move forward. In other words, kids who want to stay online will stay online, and I don't consider those students hybrid. Those are my online kids whose parents have chosen. I just want to stay online for the whole year. I'm just not comfortable. That option will remain. The hybrid design, though, is more to really create smaller classrooms. In other words, I have high schools of over 2,000 students. There's no way, even if, let's say, 70% decide they want to come in, let's say 30% stay home, or even 40%, I'm still dealing with over 1,000 students in these classrooms, which is going to make it hard to do social distancing, particularly with 6 feet, you know, and keep cohort students together. In those cases, these hybrids make more sense and, so that we can reduce the amount of students in the classroom. So in other words, it would look something like this. Half the students would come in on Monday and Tuesday. The other half would come in on Thursday and Friday. And Wednesday would be kind of a makeup day for students that way. That way, if you had a classroom of 30 students and half of them are coming in at any one point in time, you're still within 15, which gives you a little bit the ability to actually separate desks by 6 feet. But these models are going to be, I think, unique to each district and depending on the size. We have districts that have high schools that are less than 600 kids. So that's going to look differently by each district. But I think the flexibility or a blueprint for each district is actually still yet to be determined by our governor's executive order. Because as of now, we're either everyone's in or everyone's home. But that idea of a flexible model is not very is not supported right now by the current.
Why do you think that's the case, though? I mean, if we're going to rely on the science and the data to determine when it's safe for kids to return to the classroom, why shouldn't it just be like on a case-by-case basis, not only for each district, but maybe for each school?
Yeah, you know, I get it, right? I mean, we want, there's many of our parents who struggle with childcare, and we want to provide options for all of our families. The reality is, if it's not safe, it's not safe. And I feel like a lot of this has become more of a political agenda than it has an agenda around what's good for the health of folks.
You're listening to Tucson's Hispanic Voices. I'm Steve Nunez. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation on the reopening of schools with Steve Holmes, superintendent of Sunnyside Unified School District. Is online learning the future of education? Tucson's Hispanic Voices. A special thank you to our sponsors. MPG Automotive, going the extra mile for you and your vehicle. HT Metals, growing our community by growing your business. The Law Office of Natalie H. Haywood. She's more than just a criminal defense attorney. She's an advocate for human rights. And theme music for Tucson's Hispanic Voices, composed by native Tucsonan Gabriel F. Romo. Stay with us. Tucson's Hispanic Voices will be right back. You're listening to Tucson's Hispanic Voices. I'm Steve Nunez. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Tucson's Hispanic Voices. I'm Steve Nunez. With schools already reopening, districts are implementing safety measures to make sure students, teachers, staff, and their families are protected from the coronavirus. We asked one teacher why she'll teach in the classroom but not let her child go back to school.
Being a teacher, I guess the nature of it is that we're selfless like that, and so we're willing to do what we feel is what's best for our students. I mean, it hurts to say that I don't want to, but at the same time, I know that it's my nature and it's my profession, it's my calling. So I'm going to do it, but not because I 100% feel like it's the best thing that I should do for my personal sake, for my family, but for my kids, yes.
Overall, according to a survey from the Democracy Fund and UCLA Nationscape Project that was conducted the week of July 9th, Americans have lost confidence in sending their children back to school. Only 44%, or less than half of those surveyed, say they would send their child back to school if restrictions were lifted by public health officials. Let's continue our conversation with Steve Holmes, superintendent of the Sunnyside Unified School District.
We've already seen in Arizona, Hayden, Arizona, a teacher who was teaching summer school classes came down with the coronavirus and as a result died. Within your district, are there teachers who are extremely afraid and are just saying, no, we're not coming back yet?
I have to say the majority of our teachers have been just so great about this. I mean, they want to see their students. They've been embracing this work. But the ones that we've heard from are really ones that have some their own health challenges. They're older. They fit a certain profile with accommodations, may have asthma, and they are legitimately worried about their own personal safety. Even though they're amazing teachers and have, you know, want to see their kids, they're having to make some really tough choices because we're wrapping all this in the politics. And so, yeah, we have a subset of teachers who are very afraid. And we've have healthy teachers who are afraid because it is, you know, there's still a lot of unknowns around this virus, and I feel like every week there's new information that kind of changes a little bit of the perspective and approach that we're going to take, which makes it, again, very challenging for school districts to make decisions when they change on a routine basis. I had a colleague of mine who used the term, which I love, the metaphor of making sandcastles, right? That, you know, every week we make a new sandcastle and someone either kicks it down or it gets washed away and you have to rebuild. And that's kind of the way we're working right now.
Let's go ahead and talk about online learning. Is online learning the future of education, or at least a combination of both online and in person?
Yeah, so it's interesting that, you know, have you framed that, because online learning has been a modality for universities and districts for many years now. This is not something new. As a matter of fact, we probably have 10 years now that we've been working with online learning spaces in our district alone. I think the issue is that institutions have not embraced it as a permanent modality for students moving forward. And I think this is where the big change is going to happen. I really do believe you're going to have students who are going to flourish in this environment and are going to want to continue, and parents who are going to want to continue in this modality independent of the current pandemic that we're in, because I do believe that it's just a modality to enjoy. If you just look at recent acquisitions of major universities with these online institutions, it should point a clear signal, right? There should be a clear signal that this is not going away. Challenge then becomes, how do you offer those multiple modality points, and what does that look like in K-12 education is what we're dealing with right now, because there are some challenges in the K-12 space where you've got some skill development that needs to happen that many times are very teacher driven and not necessarily are supported in that online space. And so I think we've learned a lot and we'll continue to learn a lot to see how this shapes out here in the future. But I don't think it's going away. I think it's here to stay.
So will the online learning curriculum differ from in-class learning?
So we've done a couple models. So there is a model that we currently offer where the curriculum in the online space is a more of a self-paced canned curriculum that meets the standards, but it's not using the materials that we traditionally use, the textbook that we traditionally use for that content area. It's been vetted and it meets the standard, but it's really more geared to students who are trying to recover credit, want more of a self-paced, where you have little video lessons and students who are much more self-motivated to actually complete the courses themselves. The kind of more mixed modality that we have is where, and that's kind of an environment we're in currently where teachers are working remotely from home, is that we curated our content that we already have access to that's being used in the classroom daily into a structure that allows it to be not only accessible online, but actually taught remotely as well. So that really is a remote learning experience using the curriculum that we have in place in what we'd call a synchronous mode, right? And synchronous is, you're going to hear the term synchronous and asynchronous now from here on out. Synchronous being where there's a teacher teaching in real time with students. Asynchronous is where the students are working on their own and going at their own pace and not necessarily a face-to-face. And so both modalities, I think, are fair game moving forward as we match teachers, because there'll be teachers that are going to love this, and there's already online institutions that are doing this for students. I just think that the traditional public school systems still have not embraced this in the way that these competitive models have.
And so with teachers teaching online, does that mean they're going to be teaching online from inside the classroom or inside their homes and doing little videos and kind of like Zoom? Where there's, you know, all the kids can just log into the Zoom account and be able to see each other and see the teacher and be able to have a conversation and a lesson and still have that engagement, which, as you know, today's kids are so used to that, especially with TikTok and Snapchat and everything. Nothing phases them technologically. Do you see it evolving into something like that? Or is it just going to be more personal, one-on-one teaching as opposed to an entire classroom type setting?
I see both, although the what you described is more what we're doing now. In other words, right now we have teachers who have their three-period. We're running like a three-period block. We are in a three-period block. Students check in every 2 hours into that classroom. So they'll have periods 1, 3, 5 on Monday, and Tuesday have periods 2, 4, and 6. They check in at certain times, and they check in. We're a Google Suite district, so everyone's on the Google Suite. So they get on a Google Hangout in their Google Classroom, and that's kind of where they have access to curriculum. And there's a direct instruction lesson that's provided by the teacher with all the students logged into the Google Hangout. Question and answers are happening, and that lesson can take, like any classroom, it could take 10 minutes, it could take 45 minutes, depending on where you're at in that learning pathway that you've developed, right? And then the teacher then either sends students on breakout rooms, where they can collaborate together and do their own breakouts in the Google Hangout, or there's time for more question and answers where they actually log out and create another conversation with the teachers one-on-one. So it's a mixture of all the modalities, and we feel like our teachers have a good handle of that. It's a little bit more different doing collaboration spaces this way, but that's a lot of the staff development we did prior to starting school. A lot of this was developed by teachers over the summer. So it's teachers actually supporting the work and making it make sense for them. And we have teachers who are given the choice to work out of their classroom or from home. I really believe we had a lot more success in our efforts in March. And I believe teachers have the professionalism to make that choice. If teachers don't have the technology at home or Wi-Fi and they want to use their classroom, they're allowed to come to our schools. If they want to stay home and they have the ability to do so in a professional manner, then we're allowing that as well. Our big concern is making sure to deliver the content in the ways that we've curated it and that they're being held accountable to making sure students are doing the work.
Obviously, all the modalities of online learning can be in place, but the biggest obstacle, obviously, in my opinion, and I'm sure we talked about this and I'm sure you share the same opinion, is the concern for kids, especially in underprivileged neighborhoods, to one, have a laptop, and two, have access to Wi-Fi to be able to continue learning online. What's the plan for that? How do we get laptops, iPads into the hands of kids and get Wi-Fi cards or Wi-Fi service to these kids whose families may not be able to afford either one?
So we've taken this equity challenge on as a district now for over 10 years. There was a deliberate effort by our district to really recognize that the digital divide was alive and well. We have the highest poverty rate across our county as a district. And so the idea that students would have access to technology, we knew at that time that was something that we need to make sure we fix as an institution. So we were deliberate in those efforts over time to have a community-supported bond, work over time to build capacity. And I can say with just great, great confidence, I think this is why we're able to move more quickly as we transition, is that every student from 4th to 12th grade in our district has been provided with a laptop, which they use daily in the classroom and take home for learning purposes. And that's been in play for now 10 years. And the reason we never really did K-3 is I still firmly believe the kinders to third graders need a lot more direct instruction. It's hard to teach a kinder how to read on an iPad. I mean, not that they can't figure it out, but to your point, I mean, we need a little bit more direct instruction in a community like ours, and that continues to be our challenge. That sets your bigger question, which is how do we do this at scale? I think now we're finally coming to grips as a nation that access to technology should be a basic need, not just something that only people that have money can have. And same thing goes with Wi-Fi. I mean, in this day and age, Wi-Fi should be like any other commodity, like water or electricity, things that, that's where information happens. And I feel like we're so behind in accessibility as a district. As a nation. I really think what needs to happen is at federal level and at the state level, there's going to have to be really big investments in infrastructure around connectivity and on ensuring that the accessibility for every student to have a laptop device or some type of electronic device, whether it becomes the modality in which things happen at school, the reality is just standards of practice. I mean, now at any major university, we had this conversation, it's hard to imagine that any student starting a university class without a laptop. And I think it's got to trickle down now that just becomes a standard of practice in our high schools, in our middle schools, in our elementaries, regardless of whether the modality is a focus directly on the technology. It's more the access and using that as just part of how we do normal routine business in schools.
You're listening to Tucson's Hispanic Voices. I'm Steve Nunez. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Tucson's Hispanic Voices. I'm Steve Nunez. As districts sort out their reopening plans, parents are emotionally torn, and rightfully so, amid this coronavirus pandemic, over sending their kids back to school. Would you be surprised if I told you political party lines play a role on whether or not to reopen schools? I didn't think so. So here's your answer. According to market research and the public opinion group Ipsos, 78% of Democrats oppose reopening schools, while 79% of Republicans support the decision. So there you have it. Proof that politics and not science is deciding the reopening of schools. We continue our conversation with Steve Holmes, superintendent of Sunnyside Unified School District.
So what about Wi-Fi cards to make sure kids have access to the internet?
I think Wi-Fi cards are a great solution. I think part of the issue still lies is who's going to pay for the monthly service, right? And so those are some challenges. Reoccurring costs for school districts are hard to manage. Right. We worked in great partnerships with local vendors such as Cox. Cox Communication has been really great with us as a district for the last 10 years. And they've done what they call a Connect to Compete program, where they have if all of our students basically qualify for Sunnyside, where they end up with a $9.95 plan for internet access at the home. The Wi-Fi card would be helpful in those situations where there is an accessibility at the home. We still have many of our residents that can't get residential Wi-Fi just because there's no infrastructure there as well. So the card has been a way of looking, or one of those hotspots has been a way of mitigating some of those efforts. But the challenge still remains not the purchasing of them, because we can buy the little devices. It's who's going to pay for the ongoing costs, and some of those make it really unsustainable for districts and aren't receiving additional dollars for that.
With online learning, obviously the kids are technically savvy, but there's a lot of parents who are not technically savvy. How do you overcome that obstacle? Is there like a tutorial or something that'll help parents understand how to use a laptop or an iPad to check up on the progress of their child?
Yes. So we've been building, as part of this transition, multiple videos and directions on our website in both English and Spanish to help parents kind of walk them through what does the Google Classroom look like, how can you go in there and look at your students' homework assignments. We have a system for checking grades. All those and the tutorials are all part of how we've been thinking about what you just said, was it parents that aren't familiar with the way we're doing things. And it's no longer just how are you teaching math, it's how are you teaching in general and how can I know what my students learning or not. And so we've been very deliberate on trying to make ensure that our parents have access and that we're actually providing on our website those types of tutorials for parents. And we actually have our principals who do parent night where they spend time kind of going through that. I think we're going to have to do a better job of it this year as we launch in this modality to make sure, you know, it's just like any kind of, you know, parent night that it becomes a standard of practice for those parents that actually want to learn a little bit more. Most parents have phones and have some familiarity with technology, so it's not as foreign as it, you know, once was. But there is definitely a difference from, you know, accessing apps on your phone and doing Facebook than going and actually doing your homework in a computer program that has, you know, a mathematics lesson that you have to get access to, which is not as simple as just clicking on an app.
At the end of this last school year, 1 in 4 classrooms in Arizona lacked a permanent teacher. And that's according to the Arizona School Personnel Administrators Association. Obviously, there's been a statewide teacher shortage for years. On top of this, how will the Sunnyside Unified School District handle a possible teacher shortage due to COVID-19 and possible teachers who are forced to go under quarantine during the school year?
So that's a great question. I'll start with the first part. I'm, knock on wood, very pleased to say that the amount of students who have subs has significantly decreased over the last 5 years here in our district. I think as of last week, we had 4 vacancies that we're trying to fill. 4 years ago, a week before school started, we had about 120 vacancies that we're trying to fill.
I recall that.
Remember that? I feel really good about the retention that we have. I think we've done a really deliberate job of making sure, because part of the shortage also teachers getting burnt out or not feeling respected. And I feel like we've done a really good job of trying to provide those types of support systems. We're not perfect. We still have people that get burnt out. But that being said, I'm pleased to say that we started the year in the best position we could possibly be since I've started here. So that's the good news. The difficult part where I'm very concerned is to your second point, which is, you know, what do we do when someone's sick, right? Or someone gets sick, right? That is still yet to be determined because we have a pool of substitutes that we can bring in. And there are people that work with our district for many years. So they're really good people who actually kind of fill in. But this kind of in and out quarantine for 14 days, I go back to my point that I made earlier. That's a real difficult thing to manage. And without the lack of contact tracing and test availability, we're going to be waiting weeks with students being without teachers if this happens. And so I have great concern not only of classrooms being vacated, but more importantly, the timelines associated with kind of a teacher thinking they have COVID, getting testing and coming back when they may not even be positive. So independent of a teacher getting sick, I could feasibly right now see a teacher who thinks they may have symptoms being out for 3 weeks because we don't have the capability to actually test and get results fast enough. So that's another layer of complexity that isn't even about a sick individual. It's about just the lack of structured systems in place to handle the pandemic in very practical ways for schools.
So with that said, what determines the level of outbreak that'll force a school or a district to shut down and start all over again from ground zero?
Those data points have not been established fully yet. I know the county public health department is working on that. One of the definitions of outbreak for a classroom is two or more individuals getting it in that classroom. But what does it mean for a whole school guidance has yet to be given for us. And so that's another one of those data metrics that we're all waiting for. And I think this is one of the reasons why we're all starting online, because some of those decision points are not set in stone. And we're operating really just creating policy on the fly, and that's not good.
There's been a lot of talk about teachers going on strike. Do you anticipate another teacher strike? Perhaps because they want to send a message to the governor that his $270 million that he allocated to schools is just not enough, because it doesn't include higher pay for teachers, better health care, nor putting their lives at risk.
I think there's going to be elevated tension over the next few weeks around a return date. There's no doubt. Whether it results in a strike or not, it's hard to anticipate, because there's so, you know, this pandemic has just created a whole layer of complexity to both logical solutions and to the politics. I mean, you also have an election coming up. All those things play into, you know, how organizing happens and what reaction to you have and what are the pressure points, right? I can't speak for our teacher union. I shouldn't. That's really up to them. I do feel like the tension is growing because of the lack of clarity from the state, and the lack of releasing health metrics. And, you know, again, we're supposed to receive all the information. I think depending on how that is released and what message is sent will determine whether this tension is going to get better or worse. But the reality is, at some point, whenever we come back into schools, if there isn't something that's driving it based on health data, then we're going to have a lot of upset teachers and staff who are probably going to do whatever it takes to make sure the decision is driven more by what's good for health and not what the politics are saying at the time.
You are listening to Tucson's Hispanic Voices. I'm Steve Nunez. We'll have a final word with Steve Holmes, superintendent of Sunnyside Unified School District, on how you can help underprivileged children maintain access to remote learning via the internet. Plus, I'll share details on other ways you can help, including donating school supplies during the 9th annual Kids Expo and Back to School drive-through event organized by Arizona Bilingual Newspaper and sponsored in part by Bustos Media, including our sister station 106.3 The Groove. Tucson's Hispanic Voices. A special thanks to our sponsors, MPG Automotive, going the extra mile for you and your vehicle, HT Metals, growing our community by growing your business, the Law Office of Natalie H. Haywood. She's more than just a criminal defense attorney, she's an advocate for human rights. Stay with us, we'll be right back. Welcome back to Tucson's Hispanic Voices. I'm Steve Nunez. I know times are really hard for so many of us, but if you are in a position to give, please consider doing so. Together, we can make a positive difference in our community. We continue our conversation with Steve Holmes, superintendent of the Sunnyside Unified School District.
What can we as parents and as a community do to support the Sunnyside Unified School District and its 16,000 students in 21 schools?
You know, I mean, on a macro level, I think we have to know that this may be longer than what we want this to be. And I think our parents and our children and our teachers really need resources to help support this, what this looks like from working from home.
So this may not just be from now until January 1. This could be the entire school year through 2021.
Yeah, who knows how long this virus is going to last, or if it's going to get worse. I mean, you have the university coming back here soon. Is that a variable that's going to change the metrics locally? Right. So you have so many moving parts, coupled with the fact that you get into flu season soon, and you know, without any type of vaccine, this may be a long game. And so there's a lot I think our community can do with resources for families, particularly for those that are struggling to find work at this time. Supporting our children with Wi-Fi is still a big issue, and accessibility. I think we've covered the computers, so there's not a need for us to purchase more computers, but there's a need for us as a community to fix this Wi-Fi situation for our families. It could be, you know, saying, hey, I'll sponsor a family for their Wi-Fi bill for, you know, 6 months. Those are things that I think are really good solutions, helping support our teachers during this time by also, you know, what we say in the conversations we have around Public education is also super important. The more we can be supportive in, you know, our public discourse around public education goes a long way to change the narrative around how this is such a bad situation for our kids and students. We really need to portray the reality of trying to make the best out of a bad situation and supporting our folks. So there's definitely financial ways, but there's also just the moral part of it, which is thanking the teacher every time, you know, you can. And looking at communities like ours and going to individual schools and saying, what can I do to help? I know we have great principals who have their own needs based on each community, but I really feel like everything happens local, right? Those individual schools really know what they need, and the more people can reach out to individual schools and adopting the schools in some way or fashion or a student, I think the better off we're going to be if this goes longer.
Amen to our teachers and their bravery and for their commitment to making sure our kids are educated. Now, with that said, I want to ask you, if there's someone out there who wants to sponsor a family to provide them with Wi-Fi service or a hotspot card or whatever the case may be, what do they need to do? Do they go to you, to the superintendent's office, and provide that funding?
So my recommendation is always start with our foundation.
Okay.
We have a Sunnyside Foundation who has done a wonderful job. Carrie Lopez Howell, our new executive director, is doing an amazing job of just garnering resources from city, county, local, private, in ways that are actually being supportive. That's probably the simplest way to go to our Sunnyside Foundation. We have a website for our foundation for that is actually a link to our webpage. If you go to our standard webpage on our school district, or you can email Carrie. It's Kerri Lopez, LOPEZ-HOWELL at sunnysidefoundation.org. That's a great place to start. If you want to go directly to a school, I welcome any of you coming to meeting with our principals are there every day doing the great work that they do. And establishing a relationship with that principal and with those families can really happen much more directly if you want to go to directly one of our schools. But I think depending on the comfort level of folks, if folks are doing this and listening and prefer to stay online, get a hold of Carrie. If they want to actually go visit a school and do a give, that's also a very both appropriate and nice way of doing a contribution.
Steve Holmes, Superintendent of Sunnyside Unified School District, thank you for coming on Tucson's Hispanic Voices. Of course, as you know, you are always welcome on this show. Say the word, and together we will get the word out on issues important to our community. Thank you, my brothers. Stay safe and healthy, and God bless you and your family.
Likewise. Love what you're doing, Steve, and it's always great to connect with you and keep doing the great work for our community. And we'll definitely going to reconnect, no doubt.
And again, congratulations on turning around the Sunnyside Unified School District and your leadership, especially through this difficult time.
Thank you, my brother. Appreciate you as always.
Despite most children starting the school year off via online learning, there's still a great need for supplies and other school items to help underprivileged kids, especially now that so many parents are unemployed during this pandemic. My next guest is Alma Gallardo. She's the director and editor-in-chief of Arizona Bilingual Newspaper. Go ahead and tell me about this year's 9th annual Kids Expo and Back to School Supply Drive and how it's going to be different from in years past.
This year, with everything that is going on with the pandemic, we didn't want to, not to stop doing it, but I mean, it wasn't a call that we have to decide. We tried to do it in one or two different places, and at the end, we decided with the city of Tucson and everybody from the Parks and Recs and Ward 5 with Councilmember Pimbrett, gave us the total green light to do it here at El Pueblo, like a drive-through event.
And how's that going to work? Everyone just gets to drive up?
The event is handled this way. We are the ones that provide the backpacks to everyone. That's how we have been doing it in the previous year. And this is happening because of the sponsorship that we have from different clients. In this case, Tucson Electric Power is providing us part of the backpacks, and we're putting all together. So we're trying to give up until 3,000 backpacks. But we are the ones, Arizona Bilingual, are the ones with our sponsors and media partners who are providing those specific backpacks.
How many backpacks again?
3,000.
Oh my goodness.
So if you're in need of a backpack or your child is in need of a backpack, you can just attend the event, no questions asked, picked up a backpack, correct?
Yes, and we're trying to give the backpacks to the kids that they're going to be in the car, not the kids that they are staying home, okay? Because there's a big difference. I mean, people, they have to be in the cars all the time. They have to wear a mask. It's very important to wear the mask. Everybody has to wear a mask. And the main entrance, according to the authorities this morning, is going to be through Irvington Road, next to the bus station. That's going to be the main entrance. It's not going to be by 6th Avenue or Nogales Highway. It's going to be the main entrance. It's going to be in Irvington Road.
And that's the Laos Transit Center right there.
Yes,
on,
uh-huh.
On just west of 6th Avenue.
Yes, that's correct. Uh-huh.
And what should children expect as far as what's inside of the backpack?
Well, it's going to be, obviously, it's going to be the backpack. There's going to be several school supplies, I mean, pencils, pens. It's going to be some notebooks. We're going to have like a water bottle, a big one by the youth census. We're going to have several other things from the Sunnyside School District and TUSD as well. And other clients that they're providing us different things to put it inside of the backpack. But we still need more supplies to fill out the backpack. So if anybody wants to donate like 500, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, that will be awesome.
So any item basically that will help the child get through
yes.
the school year, especially right now that we're dealing with so much and then so many parents are still out of work and not able to return full time. Right now, the need is greater than ever, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. No. It's incredible. And let me tell you something. I just have my daughter's orientations today. And I mean, they're asking for a full list of the school supplies. I mean, it doesn't matter that they're going to be online. They still need it. So, I mean, in taking in consideration that a lot of families, their mothers suffering, a lot of them, they don't have a job or something like that. I mean, there's a lot of need, you know that. And,
yeah.
And I mean, that's why we wanted to host this event, because we knew that it was very important for the community.
And again, give us a shout out to all of the sponsors and everyone taking part in this, because I think everyone deserves recognition for this.
Oh, yes. I mean, we have Tucson Electric Power. We have Tucson International Academy. We have Fun Water. We have Walgreens. We have several other sponsors like Vantage West. It's always promoting the event. We have Food City. We have Chick-fil-A. We have Tucson Unified School District. We have Sunnyside School District. We have the Mexican Consulate. They're providing up to 3,000 packages of books in Spanish. So they're going to be giving those books in Spanish, the ones that we use in Mexico. And then we have also the Arizona-Mexico Commission. We have the office of the Mayor Romero, office of Council Member Richard Fimbers, that is the one that is supporting us this event in Ward 5. We also have, well, the U.S. Census. We have Dancit. We have 520 Boys. And we have Skyline Roofing. Also, I wanted to really, really appreciate what you're doing with 106.3 and 10:30 a.m. La Poderosa Radio, Azteca Tucson, Parks and Recs, Estrellas in Arizona, and REA Media Group. And obviously, thank you to my amazing team in Arizona Bilingual Newspaper.
Yes, thank you, Arizona Bilingual Newspaper. And one thing we should mention, there will be sponsors there or businesses there
yes.
that will also
yes.
be handing out additional supplies to the kids who have their parents drive up to pick up the backpacks, correct?
Exactly, Steve. There's going to be not the ones that we used to have, because usually in previous events, we have up to 40 sponsors. In this opportunity, we're going to have between 10 and 15 sponsors, but they will be handing out valuable information, community resources, and they're gonna be giving away school supplies or things that the kids are gonna be needing.
Well, once again, thank you for all that you are doing. Not only you as Alma Gallardo, but as the Arizona Bilingual Newspaper and all of your partnerships within the community. That's just detriment to all of the hard work that you've done, all the good services you've done, and now you're putting it to fruition to make sure no child is left without school supplies for this upcoming school year. Whether they're learning online, but at some point they're going to have to return to the classroom. So thank you so much.
We hope so. We hope so that things are going to be the way it used to be. And thank you, everyone there, Steve. I mean, especially to you, Patty Ruiz, and Felipe. Thank you very much for being able to support us with this event and with your radio station. I mean, it's much appreciated. And thank you to the community. And Theo, we have some time left. If somebody wants to donate, they can call us to 520-305-4110.
Thank you, Alma. Stay safe and healthy, and God bless.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the wonderful people that is listening to you all the time.
That does it for this week's Tucson Hispanic Voices. Once again, the 9th Annual Kids Expo and Back to School and Backpack Giveaway event is taking place on Saturday, August 15th from 9 in the morning until noon at the El Pueblo Neighborhood Center next to the Laos Transit Center. That's located at 101 West Irvington Road. Children must be in the vehicle to receive a free backpack filled with school supplies. Spread the word and make sure parents whose kids are in need know about the event. A special thank you to our sponsors, MPG Automotive, going the extra mile for you and your vehicle, HT Metals, growing our community by growing your business, the Law Office of Natalie H. Haywood, more than just a criminal defense attorney, she's an advocate for human rights, and theme music, composed and performed by native Tucsonan Gabriel F. Romo. Tucson's Hispanic Voices, Saturday mornings from 10 to 11, right here on KBOI 1030 The Voice. I'm Steve Nunez. See you on the radio next week.